Then the trial began. Mr. Chatham went first. He faced the jury and said,
"The state has found 6 new witnesses who will place the defendants," he pointed at Bryant and Milam, "with the Negro boy several hours after he was taken from Mose Wright's shack. These witnesses will present absolutely newly discovered evidence that will convince you, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam kidnapped and murdered the child named Emmett Till."
The first witness was Emmett's uncle, Mose Wright, a poor sharecropper and part-time minister from Money. The courtroom was so packed with spectators that the small old Negro man had to push his way through the crowd to get to the witness chair. The chair was almost too big for him, and he sat at the edge of it, uncomfortable. After he sat down, Bryant and Milam glared at him for a moment, and then they sat back and ignored him. Mr. Chatham approached the witness chair like he thought a fast move might scare Mose Wright out of there.
"Uncle Mose," he said, "what was your relationship with the deceased child?"
"Bobo Till was my nephew."
His voice was clear and strong, not a hint of fear in it.
"He come down from Chicago to visit family for a spell. Tell us what happened early on the morning of Sunday, August 28th.
Mose Wright straightened up, looked at Bryant and Milam, and then at Mr. Chatham.
"About 2 o'clock, somebody come pounding at the door. They said, 'Preacher, preacher.' One of them said, 'This is Mr. Bryant.' I got up and opened the door. Mr. Milam was standing at the door with a pistol in his right hand and a flashlight in the other."
"Uncle Mose," said Mr. Chatham, "do you see Mr. Milam in the courtroom?"
Nobody moved. Not even the children who had been playing on Bryant's and Milam's laps. It felt like everybody was holding their breath, waiting for a bomb to go off. Mose Wright stood up from his chair and pointed a knobby finger at J.W. Milam.
"There he is."
Everybody who'd been holding their breath let it out all at once and started talking. Somebody shouted,
"Lying nigger, and lynch him!"
A woman moaned. Somebody was crying. It took Judge Swango a lot of pounding and shouting to get things orderly again. While all this was happening, Mose Wright stood as calm as Jesus on stormy water, like he couldn't see or hear the hell that had broken loose in Judge Swango's courtroom. When the judge had the room quiet again, Mr. Chatham walked up to the witness chair and rested one hand on the armrest.
"Uncle Mose, do you see the other man who was on the porch that night?"
"Yes, sir. That's him there."
He pointed at Bryant.
"Mr. Roy Bryant?"
"Yes, sir."
"Objection?"
J.J. Breland jumped to his feet.
"Objection! Your Honor, I object to this wild, unsubstantiated testimony."
Mr. Breland looked ready to deliver a speech, but Judge Swango stopped him in mid-sentence.
"Overruled. You'll have your chance to cross-examine."
Mr. Chatham nodded to the judge and then turned back to his witness.
"What happened next, Uncle Mose?"
"Well, Mr. Milam had that pistol, and he asked me if I had the boy out of Chicago. Then one of the men said, 'I wants that boy who done that talk at Money.' They shoved past me and went looking in the back bedrooms, and a minute later they dragged Bobo from his room, shaking him and saying hateful things. Poor old Bobo was a-trying to get dressed as they dragged him to the front door. I was scared. I didn't want them hurting my nephew, so I asked them what they was going to do with the boy, and Mr. Milam, he said, 'If he's not the right boy, we are going to bring him back and put him in bed.' Before they got to the door, one of the men asked me how old I was, and I told him, 64, and he said, 'You better not cause any trouble, preacher, or you'll never live to be 65. By then my wife heard all the fuss and come out of the bedroom a-crying and begging them to leave the boy home. That made the men real mad, and one of them hollered, 'You get back in the bed, and I want to hear those springs.' My wife said, 'Listen, we'll pay you whatever you want if you release him,' but they just ignored her. I stayed on the porch while they dragged Bobo out to their car. They hit him a couple times to make him stop complaining. The car didn't have no lights on, and they pulled Bobo up to the back door and asked somebody inside, 'Is this the boy?' And somebody said, 'Yes.' Was that a man's voice or a woman's?
Mr. Chatham asked. Mose Wright shifted in his seat.
It seemed lighter than a man's. Was there anyone else in the car?
Yes, sir.
Looked to me like a man was sitting in the back seat along with her.
What happened next, Uncle?
I heard them slap the boy a few more times, heard him cry out. Heard car doors open and close, then they drove away with the lights still off.
His face turned sad.
Didn't ever see the boy alive again.
Were you at the Tallahatchie River when a body was pulled out 3 days later?
Yes, sir.
Did you identify the body?
Chatham asked.
It was Bobo. Emmett Till. I watched the sheriff and his helpers pull him out of the water. And I got a good look at him. He had no face hair. Bobo never did have no face hair on him. And the boy didn't have no clothes on. But they did find a ring on one of his fingers with the initials LT on it.
Mr. Chatham turned to face the jury.
You saw the ring?
He asked without looking at Mose.
Yes, sir. Exact same ring the boy's daddy, Lewis Till, used to wear. I saw it on Bobo many times.
Mr. Chatham nodded at the men in the jury, then said,
No further questions, Your Honor.
As soon as Mr. Chatham sat down, J.J. Breland jumped out of his seat to start questioning.
Mose, you got a porch light on that old shack of yours?
No, sir.
So at 2 a.m. things would be pretty dark out there.
I reckon so.
Didn't you tell defense lawyers that the only reason you thought it was Mr. Milam at the door was because he was big and bald?
Mose sat silent.
All you saw was a bald-headed man?
That's right.
And had you ever seen Mr. Milam or Mr. Bryant before that night you claimed the boy was kidnapped?
No, sir.
Was there ever any light turned on in the house?
No, sir.
Did you ever see the flashlight shine in Mr. Bryant's face that night?
I could see him good enough.
So, old Mose, it was completely dark inside and out, and the only light came from a flashlight. A flashlight shining directly in your face.
Mr. Breland grinned and shook his head.
And yet you could see clearly. Clearly enough to accuse two white men of murder. To claim that the men on your porch were Mr. Bryant and Mr. Milam over there. Could have been any two men, white or black, for all you could see, Mose.
He looked at Mose, his smile gone now.
You got a problem with white people, Mose? Are you trying to even some old score?
Mose didn't answer.
You hear me, boy? Do you have a problem with white people?
No.
No problem with white folks. Yet there you sit accusing two of our upstanding white citizens of barging into your home in the middle of the night, pointing a gun and a flashlight in your face and hauling off your nephew. That sounds pretty far-fetched to me, Mose, does it to you?
Mose looked him in the eye and swallowed before answering.
No, it don't. It's what happened, and that's God's honest truth.
Mr. Breland smiled again.
The state's only eyewitness to this crime is an old man seeing things in the dark. Wonder what those other surprise witnesses have seen.
I tell you what, Mose, this sure is somebody's kind of truth, but I wouldn't be ascribing it to God.
People in the courtroom laughed and somebody started shouting. But Judge Swango quieted them all down by pounding his gavel. Mr. Breland shook his head like a little kid in trouble and sat down. Next, Mr. Chatham called Sheriff Smith to the stand. When I heard his name, my stomach about dropped right out of me. Was I next? Would the sheriff tell what I had told him about R.C.? I shivered as he was sworn in. As soon as Sheriff Smith sat down, Mr. Breland stood up.
Objection, Your Honor. We object to this witness and insist the jury be excused until we can see if this witness is qualified to testify as to facts pertinent to this case.
Sustained, the judge said.
And while the jury moved out of the courtroom, Sheriff Smith shifted uncomfortably on the stand.
Proceed with your questions, Mr. Chatham,
the judge said when the jurors were gone.
Sheriff, I believe that early on the morning after Emmett Till's abduction, you arrested Milam and Bryant on suspicion of kidnapping.
That's right.
And what did they tell you when you picked them up?
Well, sir, they admitted they had kidnapped the boy. Mr. Bryant, he said he went down there to Mose Wright's house and brought the boy up to his store and money. And he wasn't the right boy, the one who did the talking and the whistling, and he turned him loose.
So they confessed to you, Sheriff, that they had kidnapped Emmett Till?
Yes, sir.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Breland stood up.
Your Honor, this testimony has no relevance to the charges of murder for which this court is convened, and I move that it be disallowed from jury and the trial records.
Judge Swango thought a moment and said,
"So granted."
When Mr. Chatham stood to complain, the judge motioned for him to sit back down.
"The state must first prove Emmett Till was murdered. The only proof is that the boy is missing. There's no evidence of criminal homicide. You can step down, Sheriff."
When Sheriff Smith left the witness stand, I let out a sigh of relief. If his testimony wasn't relevant, mine probably wasn't going to be either. When the jury came back in, the next witness was Chester Miller, a Negro undertaker who had helped with Emmett's body when it was pulled out of the Tallahatchie.
"It was a Negro boy for sure,"
he told Mr. Chatham.
"Bruised and beat up something awful. The whole top of his head was crushed in so bad that a piece of his skull bone fell out in the boat when they pulled him out of the water."
"Was there a ring with the initials LT on the boy's hand?"
Mr. Chatham asked.
"Yes, sir."
Mr. Chatham thanked him and sat down. Chester Miller looked scared when Mr. Breland started questioning him. Before he asked his first question, Mr. Breland stood in front of the witness chair and stared at him for a few seconds. Then he asked in a real loud voice,
"Chester, what kind of training do you have?"
He looked confused and said nothing.
"I mean, what qualifications do you have?"
Chester stared into his lap, barely breathing.
"Look at here, boy,"
Mr. Breland's voice turned mean. "You've got to answer me when I talk to you."
Yes, sir.
"Do you have any medical or undertaking training?"
"Ain't never been to a doctor, sir."
The audience snickered, and Mr. Breland turned and looked at us like a teacher who just doesn't know what to do with a dumb student. He turned sideways and sighed.
"Chester, can you tell me what you do for a living?"
"Collect folks' dead ones and get them buried."
"So you're a mortician." Again, Chester looked confused. "An undertaker?"
"Yes, sir."
"Chester, when you first saw this body, did you recognize it? Was it Emmett Till?"
"Well, his head was beaten up pretty bad, so it'd have been hard to tell right off who it was, no matter what, but—"
Breland interrupted him.
"When you first inspected it, did you or did you not know the body was that of Emmett Till?"
"I never knowed the Till boy,"
Chester said softly.
"So right then, without a picture or a family member, there'd have been no way to tell."
"So," Breland said impatiently, "you were never able to make a positive identification of this body."
Then in a kind voice he asked, "You didn't know who it was. But did you determine the exact cause of death?"
"No, sir. I couldn't tell any one thing for sure. The boy's body had bruises and cuts all over, and his head was pretty much caved in from a beating and being shot, I guess. And somebody had wired an old pulley around his neck. And there was one other thing."
He paused and stared at the floor, nervous and embarrassed.
"The boy's manhood had been cut clean off."
Hearing what had happened to Emmett chilled me to the bone, and I would have been sick if I hadn't seen the look on Mr. Breland's face. The description of Emmett's corpse didn't even faze him. You could tell he didn't care a hoot about this Negro boy who'd been tortured and murdered. I wanted to jump up and scream at him, at all the hard-headed, heartless people in the room.
"Have you ever been to a school for undertakers, Chester?"
Mr. Breland looked irritated.
"Have you ever had any training? An apprenticeship in the mortuary profession?"
Chester paused. Finally, he said,
"No, sir. I ain't never been to no school."
Breland nodded, and with his hands folded behind his back, he walked over to face the jury. He looked like he was trying not to laugh.
"No, of course you wouldn't have,"
he said almost to himself. "So other than the experience you have collecting dead folks, you really have no expertise at all to make a positive or scientific identification of a corpse. You see," he swept his arm from the jury to the witness chair, "even one of their own cannot testify with a surety as to the identity of the body that was pulled from the Tallahatchie River." The next witness was Sheriff Strider, who had also been at the river when Emmett's body was pulled out. When Mr. Chatham asked him if he knew the cause of death, the sheriff looked smug and said, "He had a bullet hole just above the ear." I closed my eyes and squeezed the armrests of my chair. I didn't want to think about the awful stuff that had happened to Emmett. Mr. Chatham thanked him and sat down. Then Mr. Breland said to Sheriff Strider,
"Sheriff, sounds to me like you know more about undertaking than some folks around here."
The courtroom audience laughed, and Judge Swango pounded his gavel again. Mr. Breland looked up at the judge with a kind of I-couldn't-help-it smile, and then asked the sheriff to describe the body.
"Well, he sure was dead," he said with a grin. Then, seeing that no one laughed, continued, "Shot to the head. Looked to have been in the water at least 10 days, maybe a couple weeks or more. A big old cotton gin pulley had been tied round his neck with barbed wire. Whoever dropped that body in the river sure didn't want it floating up any time soon."
"Did you notice anything in particular about this corpse? Anything that could help identify it?"
"All I could tell about that body was that it was human. It was in such bad shape, I couldn't even be sure if it was white or Negro."
He looked at Mr. Breland, waiting for another question, but Mr. Breland said nothing. So the sheriff continued,
"You know, there's some folks, some groups, rabble-rousers and the kind, that would do anything to stir up trouble down here. They're bent on disrupting our way of life, and I wouldn't put it past them killing somebody, sticking some boy's ring on him and throwing his body in the river. Could be that Till boy is right now sitting in Chicago or somewhere up north having a good old time with all this trouble going on down here. No, sir, that body'd been in the water a good 2 weeks, long before that Negro boy got himself kidnapped. The corpse they pulled out the Tallahatchie was no more Emmett Till than I'm a jackass."
When Emmett Till's mother walked up to the witness chair, I was afraid people in the courtroom were going to jump out of their seats and knock her down. Looks of hate, pure meanness, followed her all the way to the stand, and I wondered, if we hadn't been in a courtroom full of police, would some people have hauled her out and lynched her? She spoke clearly, and she didn't look either scared or mad, just kind of sad, like she was still hurting something awful for Emmett. "Emmett was born and raised in Chicago," she told Mr. Chatham, "so he didn't know how to be humble to white people. I warned him before he came down here. I told him to be very careful how he spoke and to say yes, sir, and no, ma'am, and not to hesitate to humble himself if he had to get down on his knees." Mr. Chatham looked sympathetic.
"Mrs. Bradley, when your son's body arrived in Chicago, were you able to identify it as him?"
"Yes, sir, positively."
"How did you do that?"
"A mother knows her child, has known him since he was born. I looked at the face very carefully. I just looked at it very carefully, and I was able to find out that it was my son, Emmett Lewis Till." Mr. Chatham went to his table, picked up a large photograph, and walked back in front of Emmett's mother.
"Mrs. Bradley, I have a photograph here,
taken at the Century Burial Association of the body that was removed from the Tallahatchie River on August 31st. I'd like you to look at it and tell me if you can identify this body."
He handed her the picture. Her face became even more somber as she looked at it and nodded, then handed it back to Mr. Chatham. "That's my son," she said softly. "My son, Emmett Till." Her voice broke, and she took off her glasses to wipe away tears.
"Are you sure?"
Mr. Chatham asked gently. "If I thought it wasn't my boy, I would be out looking for him now." I could hardly stand to look at Emmett's mother, and I prayed she wouldn't look at me. I was afraid if she did that, I'd just fall apart crying, that I'd confess all the things I didn't do, things I might have done that could have saved Emmett. I'd stand up and shout to the judge, jury, and everybody in the courtroom that R.C. Rydell had been a part of this, that he told me he was going to do something. But she never did look at me, never even glanced in my direction. The next witness was Willie Reed, a Negro kid about my age. He was so scared that he could hardly talk, and Judge Swango had to keep telling him to speak up so the jury could hear him. It looked to me like Willie didn't want anybody to hear him, didn't want anything at all to do with this trial. But as I listened to him tell what he had seen and heard after Emmett had been kidnapped, I admired him. As a Negro testifying against two white men, he'd never be able to stay in Mississippi, probably never even be able to visit here again. He had a lot more guts than I did. When Willie said that he saw some white men in a blue Ford pickup with Emmett Till in the back, Grandpa's breathing started getting noisy. His face turned fish-belly white and sweat poured off his forehead. He didn't even notice me looking at him. So I touched his arm and said, "Grandpa, you okay? You didn't forget your medicine this morning, did you?" Grandpa looked at me glassy-eyed like he'd just come out of a dream. "Are you feeling all right?" I asked. It looked like maybe his diabetes was acting up. I hoped it wasn't another stroke. "Do you need a drink or something?"
"That Sunday morning, you fixed us breakfast," he said, his voice raspy. "And we played cards, remember?"
"Yes, sir. Stayed home all morning because neither one of us felt any good."
"That's right. Yes, of course, that's right."
I had no idea what he was talking about, but whatever had hit him must have passed because the color came back into his face.
"I'm fine, son," he said quietly. "Just been sitting in this hot old courtroom for too long."
He sat up straighter and looked at the witness stand real serious, like he was trying to hear every word. Willie Reed was talking about how he saw some white man come out of a barn on the plantation owned by Leslie Milam, J.W.'s brother.
"I heard someone getting licked pretty good inside there, and lots of crying. After some more licking, he cried, 'Mama, Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy.' And I went running to my aunt's house to ask who was getting beat over in the barn."
"Did you recognize any of the men?" asked Mr. Chatham.
"Mr. J.W. Milam. I saw him leave the barn and get a drink from the well and then go back inside."
"Objection!" shouted Mr. Breland. "Your Honor, I object to this witness."
"Grounds?"
asked the judge. "This testimony does not officially connect my clients with whatever was going on in that barn. This witness is merely speculating about what might or might not have happened."
"Overruled," said the judge. "Continue your questioning, Mr. Chatham."
Mr. Chatham nodded to the judge.
"Willie, did you notice anything else about Mr. Milam when you saw him outside that barn?"
"He was wearing a pistol. Had it strapped in a holster on his hip."
"Objection, objection!"
Mr. Breland was on his feet this time. I didn't hear all that he said because I was still worried about Grandpa. His breathing had gotten easier, but he was fidgeting in his chair now, He couldn't seem to get comfortable. The judge overruled whatever it was Mr. Breland had been complaining about, and Mr. Chatham asked Willie Reed another question.
What did you do next?
I went to the country store to get some things. Then I went home and got ready for Sunday school.
On the way back, did you see or hear anything or anybody?
No, sir.
Was the pickup gone?
Yes, sir.
When Mr. Breland had his turn to ask Willie questions, he'd looked like a bull about to rip into a poor old farmer, and Willie looked scared.
Do you know Mr. J.W. Milam? He asked.
No, sir, but I've seen him round the plantation 3 or 4 times.
Have you seen that blue Ford pickup before?
No, sir.
Then you can't say for sure that it belongs to either of my clients, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Did you see Mr. J.W. Milam driving the truck?
Willie shifted in his chair, looking more and more nervous.
I don't know, sir.
You wouldn't say Mr. Milam was inside the truck?
No, sir, I wouldn't.
Hearing that made Mr. Breland loosen up a little.
Willie, how far were you from the barn when you saw who you thought was Mr. Milam?
Don't know, sir. A ways away.
A ways? How far exactly is a ways?
Willie didn't answer. Mr. Breland turned and pointed to the back of the courtroom.
Is a ways from where you sit to the courtroom doors?
No, sir.
Farther?
Willie nodded.
Twice as far?
Don't know, sir. I wasn't thinking about the distance at the time.
Well, boy, what were you thinking about? If you weren't thinking, how in the world can you be so sure you saw who you claim you saw?
Again, Willie said nothing.
Think hard, boy. From where you were standing when you heard the licking and the hollering, how far is it to the barn? 100 yards? 200? 300? Think, boy. You're sitting in a court of law, sworn to testify in front of these good people, and we're all waiting for your answer. Come on, Willie.
Willie mumbled something too softly to be heard.
Speak up, boy, said Mr. Breland.
Willie looked embarrassed and confused.
Guess maybe it was round 400 yards?
400 yards, Mr. Breland whistled. That's nearly a quarter of a mile. You've got yourself a damn good set of eyes, boy. Better get yourself off to Korea and let the army use you as a sharpshooter.
Willie tried to say something more, but Mr. Breland wouldn't let him. You're done. Just go sit down for a while. Looking relieved, Willie left the witness chair and walked straight out of the courtroom without once looking up. After Willie was gone, Mr. Chatham looked down at the papers spread out on the table in front of him, like he was hoping to find something he'd forgotten or overlooked.
Does the state have any more witnesses?
Judge Swango had to ask him twice before he finally looked up. Mr. Chatham rose slowly and glanced around the courtroom. Then he looked at the judge and said,
No, Your Honor. The state rests.
Mr. Breland and his lawyers smiled when they heard that. A couple of his assistants even patted him on the back.
Does the defense have any witnesses? Asked Judge Swango.
Mrs. Carolyn Bryant, said Mr. Breland.
Mrs. Bryant, a pretty young woman, patted her husband on the shoulder and stepped around him to walk up to the witness seat. Mr. Breland made a big show of acting like a gentleman and helped her get seated. Then he asked her to tell what had happened to her at her husband's store in Money on the night of August 24th. Before she could start talking, though, Judge Swango dismissed the jury.
This event happened too long before the abduction of Emmett Till, he said. It is not immediately relevant to this case and may prejudice the jury's deliberations. However, I will direct that it be entered into the court record.
Mrs. Bryant smiled shyly at the judge and waited until the jury had left the room. She kept shifting in the witness stand, not sure where to put her hands, not sure where to look. When she made eye contact with her husband, she nodded and stopped fidgeting. And that's when I remembered what the paper had first reported about the kidnapping, that there had been three men and a woman in the car that night. She told Mr. Breland that she had been working in their store alone because her husband was on a business trip. "While I was working, a Negro boy came into the store and stopped at the candy counter. I noticed that he spoke with a northern brogue. He ordered some bubble gum, and when I held out my right hand for some money," she shivered, "he caught my hand and wouldn't let go. I tried to pull my hand away, and he said, 'How about a date, baby?'" The courtroom had been deadly silent. But then a woman gasped, and I heard muttered swearing. A man behind me said,
"No wonder that nigger ended up in the river. I hope they made him pay good before they tossed him in."
The evil emotion in the room almost choked me. Didn't these people know they were talking about a 14-year-old boy? I shook my hand loose and started to the back of the store. "He caught me at the cash register," her voice shook, "and he put both hands around my waist. He said, 'What's the matter, baby? Can't you take it?' I pulled myself away from him, and all the while he was saying filthy, unprintable words, words which I will not repeat. Then he said, 'I've been with white women before.'" The murmur in the courtroom grew louder, and Judge Swango banged on his desk to quiet everyone down. Mrs. Bryant waited until the judge signaled her to continue. Then another Negro came in and pulled him out of the store. I started to go to the car to get my pistol, and he was still on the front porch of the store. He smiled and whistled at me, then ran off with his friends, got in a car, and drove away. "Was this Negro man who accosted you Emmett Till?" She paused and looked at her husband a moment before answering. "I don't know Emmett Till. I've never known Emmett Till, or any other Negroes for that matter." Chapter 15. A huge thunderstorm woke us early Friday morning. Lightning lit up the sky and rain pounded our roof and windows. I had hoped that the morning rain would make the courtroom more bearable, but the rain stopped early, and the humidity it left behind only made the air in Sumner hotter and heavier. The courtroom was packed that morning. Grandpa figured this would be the last day of the trial. And I guess so did everyone else in Mississippi. Deputies brought in extra cane-bottom chairs and squeezed them in wherever there was floor space. Spectators, newsmen, and photographers jammed the foyer outside the courtroom, and everybody was waiting for something big to happen. Mr. Breland called a bunch of character witnesses to testify, and each of them said about the same thing. Milam and Bryant had been born and raised in Mississippi. Milam was a war hero. They were good boys, hard workers, and never caused anybody a bit of trouble. When the seventh witness finished, I was just about asleep. Then I heard Mr. Breland tell the judge,
"Your Honor, the defense rests."
A few people started clapping until Judge Swango stared them down. He looked at Mr. Chatham and asked,
"Is the state prepared for its final argument?"
Mr. Chatham nodded, walked to the jury seats and faced them, looking at each juror one at a time. When he finished making eye contact, he started speaking so loudly that it made me and Grandpa jump in our seats. He reviewed all the details. The eyewitness testimony of Mose Wright and Willie Reed, the prior confession of Bryant and Milam to kidnapping, the positive identification of the body by Emmett's mother and others. Then he became very serious. He stopped pacing in front of the jury, took a deep breath, and continued with the last part of his speech.
"The first words that entered this case, 'I want the boy from Chicago who did the talking at money,' were dripping with the blood of Emmett Till. As far as the state of Mississippi is concerned, this is not about race. It's just another murder. But I want to say to you that the murder of Emmett Till was a cowardly act and a brutal and unnecessary killing of a human being. His abduction at gunpoint was unjustified. This was a summary court-martial with the death penalty.
That child had done nothing that would cause the defendants to invade the privacy of that home. When Bryant and Milam took Emmett Till from the home of Uncle Mose Wright, they were absolutely and morally responsible for his protection. I was born and bred in the South, and the very worst punishment that should have occurred, if they had any idea in their minds that this boy did anything wrong, was to take a razor strap, turn him over a barrel, and whip him. I've whipped my boy, you've whipped yours. A man deals with a child accordingly as a child, not as a man to a man. The killing of Emmett Till was a cowardly act committed by the two defendants you see sitting before you. I know what you are and where we are, but I beg you to put aside race, tradition, and prejudice and consider the facts of this case that we have so clearly presented. This is not an issue of Negro versus white. This is not an issue of North versus South. This is a simple issue of law. Two men murdered a child. You have no other choice but to convict them for murder. When he finished speaking, he stayed in front of the jury, looking again into the eyes of each one. Not a single man tried to avoid his gaze. Then it was J.J. Breland's turn. He walked confidently to the jury, smiled, and while pointing to Bryant and Milam, said, "I've known those two boys for years. They're men of good reputation, respected businessmen in the community, what I'd call real patriots, 100% Americans. This trial has been a waste of the state's time and money. The prosecution talked generalities because the facts just didn't bear out the guilt of these defendants. Where's the motive?" he shouted. "Where's the motive?" "It's plain and simple that the state has no case, no evidence, no identification, no motive. They claim that Till's wolf whistle at Mrs. Bryant at her store in money gave my clients enough reason to kill the boy. But both these men have testified to the authorities that they released the boy, unharmed, after his abduction because they determined he was not the one who had done the whistling. In no way did the state link up the dead boy with these defendants. Mrs. Bryant's own testimony did nothing to implicate Till in the incident at her store. She made it clear that Till never had anything to do with her, that she'd never even seen the boy. So why, I ask you, would her husband go out of his way to injure a Negro boy who had committed no offense against him or his family? The only testimony that suggested Emmett Till did anything in connection with these defendants was Mose Wright's testimony, that he had heard that the boy had done something. However, any fool knows that if Mose had known Emmett Till was involved in something down there, he would have gotten him out and whipped him himself. And how could old Mose Wright tell whether the alleged kidnappers were black or white when he had a flashlight shining directly into his face in a completely dark house? It was so dark that night that Mose couldn't even determine the make of the abductor's car. Then he claimed the man identified himself as Mr. Bryant. I ask you, how many Mr. Bryants are there in the state of Mississippi? Had any of you gone to Mose Wright's house with evil intent, would you have given your name? There's nothing reasonable about the state's theory. If that's identification, if that places these men at the scene... He paused a moment, then shouted each word. Then none of us are safe. I wouldn't put it past the NAACP and other northern rabble-rousers to plant a body in the Tallahatchie River and claim it was Till. There are people in the United States who want to destroy the way of life of southern people. The state did not prove the body was Till's. It couldn't have been. You heard witnesses, qualified professionals, testify that the body had been in the water 2 weeks or more, while Till had been missing only 3 days before that body was found. Believe me, there are people who will commit any crime known to man to widen the gap between the white and colored people of the United States. They would not be above putting a rotting, stinking body in the river in the hope it would be identified as Emmett Till. My friends, these cold, calculating groups along with the northern media are doing everything they can to disrupt this trial, to destroy the South. I am sure that every last Anglo-Saxon of you has the courage to free these men in the face of that pressure. We have got to use our legal system to protect our God-given freedoms.
If we do not, we have sinned before God and before our fellow citizens of the great state of Mississippi. He paused, and then continued with a quieter, even more serious tone. If you convict these two men, it would be admitting that freedom is lost forever. I'll be waiting for you when you come out from your deliberations. If your verdict is guilty, I want you to come to me and tell me where is the land of the free and the home of the brave. I say to you, gentlemen, your forefathers will absolutely turn over in their graves if you don't set these boys loose. When Mr. Breland finally sat down, the judge sent the jury out of the courtroom to decide whether or not Bryant and Milam were guilty. It seemed like a simple case to me. Mr. Breland's argument was so full of holes that even I could see he didn't have a leg to stand on. There was no doubt that Bryant and Milam were guilty, and I was sure the jury would see it the same way. A few people left the courtroom, but Grandpa and I stayed in that sweat box and waited. It had been a long week, and Grandpa looked exhausted. When the jury was dismissed, we talked a little, but then he dozed off and I decided to let him sleep. I figured the jury would be out for quite a while. But barely an hour later, they came back in. When the judge asked them if they had a verdict for Bryant and Milam, the foreman stood up.
Yes, sir.
He cleared his throat and read from a paper he held.
We find the defendants not guilty.
The words triggered cheering and celebration. Bryant and Milam shook hands and slapped backs with their lawyers. Then they turned and kissed their wives. Somebody handed both of them cigars, and Milam lit his up immediately. Now that the trial was over, photographers were free to snap photos, and flashbulbs were going off all over the room. People acted like it was the 4th of July, and the Korean War had just been declared over. But in the midst of all that celebrating, I felt like someone had knocked the wind out of me. How could the jury find them innocent? These two men and others had murdered a boy, and now their fellow citizens had not only turned them loose, but were celebrating. It made me sick, and all I wanted to do was get out of there, out of Mississippi, and back home where things and people weren't so crazy. Grandpa didn't cheer and clap like most white people in the courtroom. As soon as the verdict was announced, he slumped forward and rested his head in his hands. He took several deep breaths, and a few minutes later, when he sat up, he looked better, almost relieved that the trial was over. Before we turned to leave, Milam, who was swarmed by reporters and friends, turned, looked right at Grandpa, grinned, and gave him the thumbs-up sign. Grandpa acted like he hadn't seen it. It took a while for the crowd to thin out enough for us to leave the courtroom. When we got to the foyer, an NBC TV reporter was interviewing Sheriff Strider about the trial.
"Is it true," the reporter asked, "that you've been getting hate mail ever since the arrest of Bryant and Milam?"
"I'm glad you asked me this," said the sheriff as he looked into the camera. "I just want to tell all those people who've been sending me threatening letters that if they ever come down here, the same thing's going to happen to them that happened to Emmett Till."
The reporter asked another question, but by then I was too far down the hall to hear what he said. Besides, I didn't want to hear anything more about this case. I'd had all I could take. Chapter 16. When we got home that night, Grandpa looked awful. His face was washed out, paler than I'd ever seen it. The trial had probably been harder on him than on me, I thought at the time, because he was worried about me testifying in the most spectacular case in the history of Mississippi. Maybe he'd had some threatening letters because of me, letters he kept to himself. There's no telling what some nuts would say to an old man whose grandson might testify on the wrong side of a local murder trial. When we sat down for supper, Grandpa sighed.
"I am glad that trial's over. Gladder than I've been for anything in a long, long time.
Maybe we can finally forget about Emmett Till and that mess up in money.
You think it's over, Grandpa? I asked. The trial's the end of it?
It's over for those two boys, that's for sure. Once you're acquitted of a crime, you can't be tried for it again.
But what about the people who helped him? R.C. Rydell, would he get away with murder?
Get that out of your head, Hiram.
Grandpa's voice sounded strong, even though he looked like a good sneeze would knock him right out of his chair.
Just you forget about it. The authorities did a thorough investigation, and there wasn't enough evidence to convict Bryant and Milam. If they'd had a good reason to suspect anyone else, including R.C. Rydell, they would have been after them in a hot minute.
But the paper said Bryant and Milam weren't alone that night. Grandpa slapped the table with his hand.
Damn it all, Hiram, you ought to be smart enough to know newspapers make mistakes. Rumors are always flying around in cases like these, and the lawyers made it clear that those Negro witnesses lacked reliability.
But what if Bryant and Milam are covering for somebody else?
It's done, Hiram, and believe you me, nobody around here is going to bring up this ugly mess again. It's over, period.
What about an appeal? Won't Mr. Chatham take it to another court? Can't he keep fighting it, maybe try to go after the other people involved? I felt bad complaining to Grandpa about the trial after all the worrying he'd done about me, but I couldn't keep quiet about it. It's just not right. Bryant and Milam getting turned loose. Everybody in that courtroom knew they were guilty. I still can't believe that jury said they weren't. Grandpa's pale face turned pink, and he put both hands flat on the table to keep them steady.
Maybe you didn't know this, son, but in the United States of America, citizens are entitled to a trial by a jury of their peers, and the verdict of the jury stands. It doesn't matter what you or anyone else in that courtroom thought about Bryant and Milam. The jury heard both arguments, considered the evidence, and concluded that those men were innocent. The case is closed, and I don't want to hear another word about it. If you want to keep beating on about that trial, go right ahead, but don't do it around me. It's what your daddy used to do, wear me out about what he thought was right or wrong. Well, Hiram, sometimes boys don't know what's right. Sometimes they've got to trust their elders. 12 adult citizens of the state of Mississippi sat in that courtroom for a full week, and they've given their informed decision. But what about no buts about it, son? You and I aren't going to talk about this again, and I'd advise you not to talk to anybody around here about it. Our community suffered enough. It's time for things to get back to normal.
We were mad at each other, so we didn't talk much for the rest of the meal. And by the time Ruth Ann cleared the dishes, I was itching to get out of there. Grandpa didn't say anything when I told him I was going for a walk. The humid night air pressed on me worse than ever. Sweat trickled down my back before I had gotten a block away from home. It was after 9 on a Friday night. A few cars passed as I walked to the bridge. Some were packed with kids looking for fun on the first night of a weekend, and seeing them made me wonder what my friends in Tempe were doing, what they'd been doing in the weeks I'd been gone. I was ready to go home, ready to leave Greenwood and Grandpa's house, ready to try to patch things up with Dad. About the only thing I'd miss from Greenwood, actually, the only person I'd miss from Greenwood, was Naomi. And I hoped she'd miss me. I walked down Front Street and cut through the back parking lot of the county courthouse. A few cars were there, probably night duty police or county jail guards. And except for those, the lot was empty, quiet and dark. Halfway across, I saw someone. A man, it looked like, step out from the shadows behind a Ford sedan parked close to the courthouse's rear entrance. He flicked a cigarette to the ground when I got closer, and before I could see who he was, he said, "Hey, sis baby, where you headed so late at night?" R.C. Rydell stepped out of the shadows, and in the light from the corner streetlight, I could see his face was bruised and swollen. Blood was spattered down the front of his T-shirt. I stopped but didn't say anything. He didn't have a knife that I could see.
"Hope you ain't looking for my little sister," he said, "'cause I don't think she's going to make your little rendezvous anytime soon."
"What are you talking about?"
"Come on, Hiram, you think I'm stupid? What kind of big brother would I be if I didn't know my kid sister had herself a boyfriend?"
"Where is she, R.C.? What happened?"
"Problems at home, our old man."
R.C. lit another cigarette, snapped the match at me, and took a long drag. "Pa really was on one tonight.
He's been mean before, but tonight he was crazy, out of control. House is a damn pigsty. Kids don't do a damn thing round here. I work all day to keep a roof over our heads, and what do I get for it? That kind of crap. Naomi knows enough to steer clear of him when he's been drinking and ranting, and so do I, usually. But tonight he started in on me for being gone, for quitting my job at the dock and going to Jackson."
"You been in Jackson?"
"No future around here. And believe me, I didn't mind getting away from Pa. I got me a job in Jackson loading trucks and might start driving one in a year or two. I've been down there almost a month already. Anyway, Pa don't like it, and he kept yelling, 'You run out on me, boy.' What he means is that he couldn't take my wages no more to buy booze. He really tore into me tonight, hollering, swearing, calling me all kinds of names. I could have took it because I knew he was drunk and that after this weekend I'd be cleared out of here for good. But he pulls out his big old leather belt, starts swinging it around, swearing, coming at me."
R.C. was breathing hard now, and even in the shadows I could see the pain on his face.
"He caught me good a couple times, and I just took it. That made him mad, so he throws the belt down and starts with his fists."
R.C.'s voice got faster.
"Hitting me in the face, kicking me, screaming like a crazy man. He popped me in the nose, blood gushed all over. It's probably broke. And that did it. That pulled my trigger, and there was no stopping me. I wailed on Paul like I was some kind of machine, hitting him in the face.